Brother Ahmad Umar, brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. It is my top privilege to welcome Brother Abdul Ahmad Umar on behalf of the Young Men's Muslim Association Conference to our national headquarters. I also take this opportunity to thank each and every one of you for being present here today. Praise be to Allah for having with us Brother Umar to speak to us on Islam and Christianity. You see before you a young, handsome professor of mathematics from Toronto, Canada. Being TV broadcaster and author of several Islamic publications, he has become an authority on this particular subject. I'm sure he will testify his thoughts to the conviction of all of us. There have been many people, or rather some people, to whom I have spoken to. In fact, it is not the subject that should have been the theme of tonight's lecture. I have no hesitation in agreeing with these people the intention of our speaker for tonight, or any person associating himself officially with this lecture, or to decry and touch the susceptibilities of our Christian brethren. I am quite certain that it is not the intention of our speaker for tonight. It is a subject of tremendous interest from the viewpoint that tonight's speaker is going to put forth. I do not believe that his intention is holding this lecture is to touch the susceptibility of our Christian brethren. I don't believe that. But I do believe that in the progressive society, one should not be inhibited to discuss matters even by pornography. There appears to be controversy. After all, if we are going to be inhibited discussions, discuss with dignity, with respect for the other man's feelings, if these are going to be inhibited, then I am afraid it will result in intellectual stagnation, and it will be a sad day for any community once has intellectually stagnated. So I don't think that one needs to offer any apologies to anybody for tonight's subject of discussion. Now, as it is customary at meetings of the YMMA, at the end of the lecture, there is going to be a question time. And therefore, I do not want to take any more of your time, because the less I talk, that there will be more time available for discussion and questions. But before I call upon the speaker, I wish to thank the Islamic Information Center for giving us this opportunity to have this lecture at our headquarters. Now I have great pleasure in calling upon the learned lecturer to address you on the subject Islam and Christianity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome. I guess I have to start by telling you what I'm not. I'm not attached to some institution. I don't work these days. Last couple of years I haven't been working, so I'm not a professor of anything these days. I took a year off, and it is stretching into 3 years. I have to get back to work someday. So I'm not associated with somebody. I don't want to embarrass some institution or myself. I'm also not in the business of traveling around and giving testimonials, that is, telling people, you know, I used to be that, and it was so bad, and now I'm this, and it's so good. I'm not in that business either. I just had in mind to possibly bring to your attention some things that maybe you have heard of before, but you thought, well, that's all been figured out a long time ago. That's all old business. As to discussing Islam and Christianity, Muslims and Christians have been doing that from the start. There's an interesting booklet recently printed in England at the Islamic Institute in Leicester, which records the history of the first encounters with Christians and Muslims. How even in the time of the Prophet himself, the Bishop of Najran came with some of his people to Medina to meet the Prophet. They wanted to discuss Islam and Christianity. And the Prophet said, make yourself at home in the mosque. And so they stayed in the mosque. And went on for some days of discussion. As to the subject at hand, Islam and Christianity, I'm afraid that the Muslim very often wants to take one big wide brush and use it to paint all the Christians one color. They ask simple questions like, what do Christians believe? Do you know that's a more difficult question to answer than if somebody asked me, tell me, what do Americans eat? All kinds of things. What do Christians believe? All kinds of things. You have all sorts of people who say, we are the true Christians and those are the false Christians. And if you go down the street, that's the group who's saying the same thing. I say, no, we're the true Christians, those are the false Christians. There's hardly one statement that you can make about Christianity that every Christian would say, yes, that's true, that's what we believe. They come in all kinds. So please understand that if I try to talk about Islam and Christianity, anything I might say, there will be some Christians who will say that's absolutely right, and there will be some who will say, no, that's wrong. So it's not as though Islam has some kind of a view which is exactly opposite to what Christians have. As a matter of fact, there is virtually nothing that you could find anywhere in Islam that you can't find a church somewhere who says the same thing. Just recently there was a little book published by an American evangelical church on an important subject. They say, one thing they know for sure, whatever Christianity is, we know one thing for sure, Christians shouldn't eat pork. They make a very big case out of it. Prove it from the Bible. According to the Bible, a Christian should not eat pork. They stick to that very firmly. It's just showing you, here's one thing out of many, many things. Somewhere you find a church who will say, on that issue, the Muslims are right. So what I'm trying to say is, don't be confused if you have this attitude like, well, there's them and there's us. It's not as simple as that. Not nearly. There are many who approach very close to the Muslim idea on virtually everything. And so it is that the Muslim is not supposed to be in the business of saying to people, leave what you have and take what I have. You're not supposed to do that directly. That's not a starting point. The message of the Quran to every human being is, whatever you have, be careful. Don't commit excess. Stick to what you know for sure, but don't exceed your own authority. If you say this and this and this, and you can prove it, that's good, it's true, we all believe it. But when you come to this subject or that subject, do you have proof? If you don't have proof, then you should be quiet. Even if you're right, you should be quiet, unless you have proof. Commit no excess. So, this exercise is not supposed to be some kind of a harangue or whatever to say, look at them and they have this idea and look how silly that is or whatever. No more so than the reasonable Christian would say that of Muslims. There again, you find people in one description or another. Just a few months ago, a man who is probably the leading intellect in the Catholic Church, Hans Kuhn, made his comment on what he thought the Quran was. He studied the Quran carefully and he said, God has spoken to man through the man Muhammad. Now that's what Hans Kuhn says about the Quran. The New Catholic Encyclopedia says in an article on the subject of Quran that people have tried to explain it away for years. And in their own words, they say, out of all these explanations that have been offered to say it came from here, it came from there, it's not really a revelation. Their own words, they say, today no sensible man accepts any of these theories. In other words, there still is not a sensible explanation for what is it if it isn't a revelation. So, some people are not automatically against you, is what I'm getting at. They call things for what they see things to be. 100 years ago, in the 1880s, when Pope Pius IX sent a delegate to Libya, his representative to Libya, he told him before he left, he said, don't go there thinking that you alone have salvation. Muslims too gain salvation. That wasn't published until about 10 years ago. But it happened 100 years ago. You have at the other end of the scale people like a minister who was in my home one time, and I told him a thing or two about the Quran. He didn't even know which book I was talking about, but I said, in that book, there's this and this and this. He said, a man couldn't write a book like that. In other words, he realized this is more than a man was capable of, and he said, the devil must have written it. So you have one extreme to the other and all kinds of things in between. Maybe it seems that if we talk about Islam and Christianity in a place where most people are Buddhist, that's out of place. Well, one reason I feel it's a good idea is because it has application in that situation. The Christian too often says, you'll find it in print if you've never heard it for yourself, but I assure you it's in print many times in many Christian publications. They'll tell you the Buddhist doesn't believe in God. The problem is that the Buddhist has such a noble and subtle and delicate idea of a certain item which is unborn that, yes, as far as a lot of people are concerned, he doesn't believe in God. Because the God they're talking about is an old man, he looks like your grandfather. Long white beard and so on. And yes, probably, if that's what you mean when you say God, the Buddhist doesn't believe in God. But the important question is, again, what do you mean when you use that word? So that the Muslim has a piece of good news, I suppose, for the Buddhist to say, my God doesn't have a long white beard either, and so on. He's a very, very subtle and delicate, noble concept, far removed from some of the pictures that people draw on what they think God is. As a matter of fact, one of his attributes is Al-Latif, which means the subtle. Just barely even there at all. We know about things like this. Allah is something else. So, I have to kind of divide the material into two parts. And I don't know why you are the fortunate ones, I suppose, or the unfortunate ones, depending on how you look at it. But Islam and Christianity, tonight, the subject is the toughest. Tomorrow is the easy one. Tonight I wanted to talk about thinking, and tomorrow I want to talk about Scripture. So if you came to hear somebody say, in the Bible it says this and that and the other thing and so on, that's tomorrow night. Tonight I'm talking about thinking, and it will be maybe some hard work for you, but that's the way the thing is divided. I want to talk about thinking because I feel this is a good place to start, because this can be our first issue and it's usually our last issue. And that is this: how do we recognize the truth when we see it? How do we know true from false if our mind is switched off? Probably 3 years ago now, I had a debate with a leader of the Campus Crusade for Christ in Canada. And when it was my turn to speak, I said, if we gathered here tonight to settle some matter of chemistry or physics or mechanics or something, we could settle our differences because we go to the blackboard and we make some calculations and we see who's right. So we could do the same thing tonight when we talk about Islam and Christianity if we'd agree on the rules that we're going to follow before we start discussing. I said, here's two rules I'd like to follow. I mentioned two things. I said, if we follow those rules, we can decide who's right and wrong. When it came his turn to speak, he said, I like those rules. Those are good rules. And 20 minutes later, he threw them out. As a matter of fact, what he had said was, He says, I especially like your second rule, which was, and said, two exactly opposite things can't both be true. If this one is exactly the opposite of that, they can't both be true. He said, I like that. Because probably what's going on in his mind, he's thinking, oh, Islam and Christianity, they can't both be true. What happened was, several minutes later, people asked questions from the audience, and they said, a man asked, he said, who was Jesus? And he talked and he talked and he talked, and when he finished, I said to him, I think the man is asking you, was he mortal or immortal? Could you kill him or not? Was he mortal or immortal? He said, oh, well, that was decided by the Council of Trent 17 centuries ago. What did they decide? Was he mortal or immortal? Well, that's the hypostatic union of the homoousion and the underlying union of both mortal and the immortal and so on and so on. In other words, it's both. So he didn't like the rule anymore. If we agree on how we recognize truth when we see it, then we can make some progress. A few months back, I was in actually, it's the oldest city in North America, and by standards in this part of the world, that's not very old. I think it's about 250 years old, 300 years old or something, in St. John's, Newfoundland. And I got into some kind of a back-and-forth thing in the question period. It was like a tennis match. The man sitting here quoted a scripture, and I quote this, and back and forth, and back and forth, and finally he said, okay, enough, I give up. He came to me after, and he said, just because you can prove I'm wrong doesn't mean I'm wrong. He said, your problem is, if you would just ask God to show you the truth, then you'd see that I'm right. So I said, well, a minimum of 17 times a day, I ask God for guidance, part of the daily prayer. Absolute minimum 17 times a day, I ask God, guide me, don't let me be misled, please, guide me. Now, he never thought about that before. He got a little bit embarrassed, then he said, oh, you're not humble enough when you pray. Which bothered me. I didn't say to him, I'm more humble than you. I simply said, well, when I pray, I put my head on the ground. How do you pray? And he went the same red color as his shirt. He was very embarrassed at that point. Then he fell down, put his head on the ground, started praying. When he got up, I reminded him, I said, don't forget where you learned to pray like that. What is the problem? If all it takes is to say, God, show me the truth, and here it comes, why is it that Muslims are not guided then? They're asking all the time. So it's not that easy. There's a passage in the Bible that mentions what it is that's going to help you out. You want to know what you ought to be doing. It's in the book of Isaiah, chapter 1, verse 16. It's talking about sins. Does he want to know how to overcome sin? It's a speech of God, reportedly. God says in this place, you want to get your sins forgiven? He says, come, let us reason together. He does not go on to say, oh, but some things won't make any sense. Never mind about those. You must believe those too. Nothing like that. He says, come, let us reason together. No excuses, no apologies, no qualification. No cutting it short, saying, only here and here will we reason, but not here. That's not reasonable. Let us reason together. So it is that there have always been people among Jews, the Christians, and anybody else who have thought that sounds like a good idea. I'll keep my mind engaged. Keep looking and thinking. Today, the scientific community know a great deal about what is actually an old idea, but now it's been made popular. At least it's popularly talked about, and it's come to be accepted as a productive way of doing business. You do a lot of your lab work, your experimentation, in your mind. It's called a thought experiment. That's how Albert Einstein did all his work. He didn't do it in a lab. Because in the laboratory, sometimes little things can interfere with your results that you don't notice, and you get off the track. But when you're doing your lab work in your mind, you have everything under control. The thought experiment works like this. You start with some ideas, and you see where they take you. And if they take you to some place impossible, then you know you started in the wrong place. As an example, Suppose a man makes the observation that virtually everything he sees, when it freezes, it gets bigger. And that's generally true. When liquid freezes, it expands. But then he wonders in particular about water. He thinks, I wonder, when water freezes, does it expand? Well, he doesn't even have to go and try anything. That doesn't have to freeze some water and measure it to find out. He can figure that out in his mind. You think about it. If water got smaller when it froze, that would mean it's denser. It's the same amount of material taking up less space. It's denser, which would mean that if ice shrinks as it freezes, then ice should sink. So that if ice forms on the river, it should sink to the bottom. If I have a piece of ice, I throw it in a glass, it should sink to the bottom if water shrinks when it freezes. But what do we know? Every piece of ice you ever saw is floating in the water. No, it must be that water expands when it freezes. It's one of the few things it does. But you don't have to do some lab work to figure that out. You steer through that in your mind. So it was in a similar spirit 17 centuries ago that one Christian got himself sent into exile for thinking about it, but it's still around. It's still called the Arian syllogism, where Arius said, well, suppose that there was a man who was God at the same time as he was man. He's God and he's man. He's not man now and God then or whatever. He is God, he is man all at the same time. Suppose that's true. But now suppose I met a man like that and I stabbed him with a knife. What happens? Does he die or does he live? If he's God, he should live. If he's a man, he should die. He can't do both. So as Arius put it, if he died, he wasn't God. If he was God, he didn't die. See, in all generosity, the Muslim can come that far, even on that subject. Say to the Christian, if you want to tell me Jesus was God, go ahead, but don't tell me he died. If you want to tell me he died, go ahead, but don't tell me he was God. I'll give you one, but you can't have both, because it doesn't mean anything. God doesn't die. I know that sometimes people try and take this apart, but Al-Ghazali talked about it 900 years ago. They'll tell you, well, this man we're talking about, he was God and man like a sandwich, you see. I mean, he's God and man all mixed together. And when he was killed, you see, the man part died, the God part lived. Well, that's an interesting idea, but then it means the God-man didn't die. See, if I tell you, today I ate a sandwich for lunch, except the bread, did I eat a sandwich for lunch? I had a piece of cheese, or whatever was on the inside. What happens to the sandwich happens to the bread. What happens to the sandwich happens to everything in it, or you didn't really eat a sandwich. If you say, we killed the God-man, but what you mean is, well, we killed the man part, the God got away, then you didn't kill the God-man. You killed the man. Which, according to the most beliefs, is not enough. If a man dies, it doesn't help us. We need the God-man to die, but we take it apart anyway at that time. And if you take him apart at the last moment in his life, it just reminds you had a problem the day before that, too. If he was God and man the day before that, tell me, did he know everything or did he just know some things? If he knows everything, he's not a man. That's not a man. Who knows everything is not a man. Who does not know everything is not God. So what about Jesus? Were there things he knew or things he didn't know? Did he know all things or only some things? You have to take him apart again. That's why a few hundred years ago, Spinoza was a Jew who had investigated philosophy and earned quite a reputation, and he pretty well separated himself from the Jewish community. And there were a lot of people who came to him and said, well, you've had the good sense not to be a Jew, you ought to be a Christian. And he said, I might, if I knew what you're talking about. He says, you tell me God became a man. I hear the words, but I don't know what it means. Can you tell me what it means? You can always put words together in a string, but what do they mean? Spinoza said, do you mean he used to be God and then he turned into a man? Is that what you mean? God became man? Do you mean whatever God is made of, it was all squeezed together and made into the shape of man? Is that what you mean? Like when you say that water is made out of water molecules, they're in the vapor, but you squeeze them together, you get a liquid? Is that what you mean? What do you mean when you say that? Because usually when you say this became that, you mean it's not what it used to be anymore. If I have a ball of clay and I shape it into a cube, I'll tell you, see, the ball became a cube. But I can't tell you, it's still round. I know it has corners, but it's still round. No, it used to be round. Now it has corners. It became, this became that. When you say God became man, you mean he's not God anymore. He used to be. If you mean he's a man and he's still God, then you have these problems. You're saying, well, then what is he? Is he mortal or immortal? Can you kill him or not? I know that there's no end to comparisons that people try to make on this, and the Church of England tried to put the brakes on that 300 years ago. They tried to stop this kind of thing. About 300 years ago, the Unitarians were causing such a fuss in England that it got to be that every Sunday the sermon was the Trinity, and someone would say, well, it's like this, you see, it's like when you have a clover and you have three leaves and one stem. Somebody else said, oh, it's like an egg, you have a shell and a white and a yolk, and so on. Every priest had a different idea. Finally, the Church of England issued orders and said, stop talking about it, you're making it worse. There's nothing like the Trinity. There's nothing you can point to and say, it's like that. There's nothing exists like that. No place. There's nothing where you have three items and each one is the whole thing. Some people will say, well, look at the triple point of water. Come back to water again. Under certain conditions of temperature and pressure, you can have water in a container, and some of it will be ice, some of it will be gas, and some of it will be liquid. So they say, you see, at the triple point, there's the three different forms that coexist. Well, yes, they do. Some of that is ice, and some of it is water, and some of it is vapor. But you can't point to any one molecule and say, this molecule here, it's liquid and it's solid at the same time. That's the point. It's a false analogy, like hundreds of others. It's either that or. If people would insist that somehow it's still possible that two opposite things can both be true, then I wonder why they worry about the Muslims. They ought to be happy enough to say to the Muslim, it's true that Jesus is God, and it's true that he isn't. We're both right. Makes as much sense. This claim and its denial should be able to coexist side by side. Everything else like that, if you say, this one was immortal, you couldn't kill him. Ah, but you could kill him. Well, if those two opposite things can both be true, so can these. The statement that says he's this, and the one that says, no, he isn't, they're both right. It makes as much sense. As one man said to me one time, after a discussion of some of these items of information, he stood up in a question period, and he said, you're absolutely right. It's impossible to believe the things that I believe. He said, unless you have the gift of faith from God, then you can believe it. If God gives you the gift, you can believe it. So, as the meeting was breaking up, he came around close to me again, and I asked him, how do I get the gift of faith from God? He said, there's only one way to get it. First, you have to believe all these things. Now, can you think about that? Saying you can't believe them until you get the gift. And when you say, how do I get the gift? He says, you won't get it till you believe them. He said, there's no belief without belief. That's like telling a man, you want to quit smoking? Look, it's easy. First thing you do is you don't smoke. Now, after that, it's easy. The requirement can't be the same as the goal. Now, of course, I also realize it's a familiar charge that people will say, the problem with you Muslims is you reject what you don't understand. That's not true. That's not what's happening. The Muslim says, well, I can't understand that, so it must be false. That's not what the Muslim is supposed to be doing. People are confusing two different ideas here. Come back to water again. They say water is made of a molecule of water is made of two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen. You mix hydrogen and oxygen, two gases together, you get water. I don't know how it works. See, I don't think anybody really knows how. Nobody's quite sure yet what an atom is. They don't know how it works, but they know it works. You can do it. I did it when I was in high school. You can mix these two gases, you get water. I believe it because I've seen it work. I don't know how, but I know what it means when somebody says, hydrogen and oxygen make water. I know what that means. Those words make sense. In fact, I can do it. I don't know how it works, but I can do it. But when somebody says, this is God and this is man, I hear the words and I don't know what they mean. Nobody does. So whether it's true or not, I still don't know what it means. That's what's going on. Even if there's a how, I don't know what you mean when you say those words. More than this, there are some things that cannot be true for the simple reason that if they are true, then they are false. There are some things like that. I'll give you an example. Back a few hundred years ago in Europe, there was an unorthodox version of the Trinity being preached, and the church was alarmed at this, said this is not the correct teaching on the subject, so they called a council. You can look it up, find the details from history. It was the Fourth Lateran Council. How the scholars, the cardinals, the leaders in the church meet to discuss, what is God anyway? To reply to this thing. And you know what their concluding statement was at the Fourth Lateran Council? They said, there is a reality which is God. It is unique and eternal. It neither begets nor was begotten, and there is none that can be compared to him. Does it sound familiar? That's the 112th chapter of the Quran. It's a pretty good translation of 112th surah of the Quran. There is a reality which is God, unique, eternal. It begets not, nor was it begotten, and there's none compared can be compared to him. In fact, that's why you'll find in most Catholic Bibles, most, not all, but most Catholic Bibles will never use that word begotten. Because it's not correct. It's not the right translation. God is not beget. Most will tell you that. Remember, my point was some things are false because if they are true, they are still false. And that's what the third line in that surah is about. It says, Lam yalid wa lam yulad. It means he begets not, nor was he begotten. You see, if God has a son, then he doesn't have a son. I'll show you what I mean. What do we know about sons and fathers? A son is the same kind of a being as his father. The son of a horse is a horse, and the son of a man is a man. And as C.S. Lewis said in his book Mere Christianity, he said, just so, the son of God is God, or he isn't really a son. Something like a son, but not really a son, unless he's the same kind of a being as his father is. If I show you a pet that I got a cat or something, I can tell you I treat it like a son, but not the son. This is a cat, this is the man. If God really has a son, his son is just like him. Now, what do we know about God? Well, for one thing, he doesn't have any parents. Nobody gave him life. What do we know about sons? To be a son means you received life. Otherwise, you're not a son. Nobody gave you life, then you're nobody's son. So to be a son means you received life. To be like God means nobody gave you life. Nobody gave you anything. If God has a son, his son is just like him. He doesn't have a father. Which means he isn't God's son after all. See what I mean? It unties itself. The reason he doesn't have a son is because he himself is not a son. What is by nature not produced cannot produce something just like itself, because that's a produced item. So it's not like the one who produced it. He was unproduced. Let that go around in your mind for a while. I said that a few years ago at a meeting, and later it came back to me by way of a certain missionary group that had been listening to these lectures, and they called that Miller's argument, which is very flattering, I suppose, but isn't my argument. It comes out of the Quran. They want to give it a name to make it go away, just the same as saying, oh, that's the Arian syllogism. It means you can put it in the box marked Arius, makes it go away.
still needs an answer.
As I say, there are people who face these things and they're working on it. And that's the kind of thing the Muslim should encourage. It's not your business, as I said before, to go telling people, oh, look, you see, you're near the truth, but leave it, here's the truth. You want to encourage the work that somebody's doing. If he's looking, tell him, keep looking. There's a book that is studied by virtually anybody who studies to be a priest or minister, that's whether Catholic or Protestant. It's called Early Christian Doctrines by J.N.D. Kelly. Kelly talks about two subjects. What is God and what do we mean by sin? And he says we still haven't finished these subjects. We still don't know what we mean when we say somebody died for our sins. Now, I don't quote that to tell you, you see, Kelly's right. I'm only pointing out that there are people within the system who say we haven't finished with this idea yet. Others, of course, will disagree with them, but there are people within the system who are still thinking, and a Muslim should encourage that and say, yes, finish what you started. Figure this out. Because what often happens, of course, is that when people are too quick to give an answer for something, they just raise more problems. They make more problems. It gets worse, but they think they've got the answers. Man told me quite a picture in Australia one time. He says, the reason that a man needs somebody between himself and God, he says, look, God is 100% holy, and man is contaminated by sin. So man cannot deal directly with God. He needs someone in the middle, the mediator. Well, that sounds like an interesting explanation, but think about it. Suppose they told you, in Los Angeles, the west coast of the United States is the holiest man that ever lived. He just radiates holiness. And some of you might say, well, I'm going to save my money. I'm going to go there. I want to meet him. I want to shake his hand. And then I'll tell you, oh, no, wait. He couldn't stand to be in the same room with you. He's too holy. You can talk to his secretary, but he won't. No one's allowed to see him. He's too holy. Can't go near him. Make him sick. Does he look like a holy man anymore, or does he look like a crazy man? You see, what I'm getting at is, it can have a nice sound to it, but think about it. Put it in real life. What if you knew somebody like that who said, look, you can't come close to me, I'm too holy. Talk to him, he'll tell me. Would you think that's a holy person or not? Besides that, as I say, a bigger problem is raised. The man is saying, God is 100% holy. He needs someone between God and man. How holy is this one between God and man? 50% or what? 99%? What is it? You ask him, how holy is the one you say is the mediator? He said, 100%. Well, you still got the same problem, man. You can't get close to the mediator. He's still too holy. It just doesn't work. Or somebody said one time, she said, look, God is like the sun, and man is like a snowflake, and if he gets too close, he melts. Well, the funny thing is, when people tell you something like that, and you ask that same person, where is God? They'll tell you, everywhere. So why aren't we melting? Pay more attention, I suppose, if you have the reported words of Jesus. It says, God is so close to you, he counts the hairs on your head. He's right up close. The Quran says he's as close as the vein in your neck. Not a problem if you're talking about closeness in some sense. Again, there are still other ways to deal with problems. Here is where, basically speaking, Christianity fell into two halves. Or one half had one idea and the other half maintains another idea. Although today, people from either half may well have the idea of the other side, and they don't realize it. But at one time, in the Protestant Reformation, these were sharp divisions. The Protestant Reformation began with an idea that here you had a man who used to worry that, he said, no matter what I do, I still sin. I try hard to behave, but every day something happens, I sin. And it pained him so badly. Because what sin meant was when you do something wrong. He said, every day I do something wrong, so every day I sin. How am I going to overcome that? Well, he overcame it by giving a new definition to sin. Definition was, sin is not when you do bad things. Sin is when you don't believe. Sin is unfaith. When you don't believe, then of course you do bad things, but that's beside the point. A sin was you didn't believe. So that you have a large group of people who see it that way. If I don't believe, I'm sinning. Well, I suggest that when you talk about belief in that way, you're not talking about belief. Belief is on account of something indicated to you that something was the case and you believe it. To give you an example, I met a man in South Africa, a medical doctor. And all medical men know about a thing they call placebo. That is, when somebody's problems are mental, but it won't help to tell him that, you give him a pill that's made out of sugar. You tell him, take this pill, it'll help. Because he believes it's medicine, that his problem was in his mind anyway, he believes he's well when he takes the pill. How it works. This man, this medical doctor, had a patient come to him. The man said, there's a snake in my ear. Well, the doctor doesn't say, that's crazy. He didn't say that. He said, well, let's have a look. The man tips his head over and he gets his instrument. He looks in his ear and he says, ah, I see your problem. The man says, you mean you can help? He says, yes, I've got just what you need. Took a little dropper. There's nothing in it but water. But he says, just lean your head over. And a couple of drops in there. And he says, that should take care of the snake. Sure enough, the man says, I'm cured. It's gone. You see, it was in his mind to start with. And when he thought he was getting medicine, he thought he was cured. But suppose that somebody says to the doctor, I've got a pain in my head, and the doctor does all the examining he can. He says, look, there's nothing wrong with you. Your pain is in your imagination. But I'll tell you what I will do. I've got some pills here. Now, they're only made of sugar, but I want you to believe that they're medicine. And take these. Then the pain will go away. Believe. You can't do it. It won't work. You won't believe it. You might hypnotize yourself, I suppose. You sit there for 2 or 3 days and go without food and water and say, pills are medicine. Pills are medicine. Then maybe you'll... That's not really belief. Belief is you put your trust in something, you have reasons in front of you, and you believe it. But it's not belief when you say, they tell me this is true, I will make myself believe it. That's not belief. And that's where you're asking, of course, for trouble. Another point that should be thought carefully about, and I stress it to Muslims, man, because very often I hear Muslims talking a great deal about faith. You know, the Quran doesn't say a word about faith. You often find that in English translations, but it doesn't say anything about faith. It talks about iman, which comes from an Arabic word that means confirmation. Your iman is what you checked on, what you know for sure, or it's what you've at least thought about, looked into, and it grows all the time. Every time you find out a new thing, your iman grows. The things you checked on grow. It doesn't say anything about blind faith, saying, this is true, there's no proof, but believe it. No such thing in Islam. But to systems built on faith, there's of course a great many problems. If faith is the key, well, the man who has it can't give it away. If faith is a thing God gives him, he can't give it to anybody else. There's an example of this. We just had another meeting. I don't know if some of you were just there and heard the same story, but if so, excuse me. But to illustrate the point, a few years ago, I had finished a meeting and I was about to leave after a talk, and somebody pointed out, somebody across the room, he said, you see this man over here, he's leaving in a few days to be a missionary to Pakistan. So I went over, talked to him. I said, what are you going to Pakistan for? He says, I'm going to take people there the proof that Jesus died for their sins. I said, like what? What proof do you have? And he opens up and he reads a passage of scripture, and I said, well, now that proves a lot of things, but if you look carefully, it doesn't prove what you said, and that, you know, explain why. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4 points. That doesn't, technically, that doesn't prove what you said. And he saw that for a moment. He said, yeah. Okay, no, this one. And he turns the page and he finds another verse. So this is the proof. I read it again carefully. I said, now look, that still doesn't quite do the job. It proves a number of things, but it doesn't quite prove what you said yet. Yeah, that's true. Closed the book and he thought about it a minute and he says, oh, wait. He says, I don't mean I have proof, I have faith. Well, that's fine. That's his business. I'm happy for him. But say what you mean. See, advertise what you're selling. And if you don't have proof, but you have faith, then you have something you can't give anybody. Proof is something a human being can give to another human being. Say, here's the proof. But faith is the thing where you say, look, inside me is the proof, the faith. But you can't open up your heart and say, you see this here? Something. In fact, you can have a little bit. You can't do that. That's between you and whoever gave it to you. That's not even to say this is a false thing you've got, but at least a person should think again about, well, what do I have? And is it something I can give somebody? Because otherwise we can, fool ourselves. I'll give you an example of a contrast. There's a famous American television preacher who tells the story on his broadcast sometime about how he got the commission from God to say the things he says. He said, it happened one morning, I was in my bathroom and I was shaving, and the light flickered, and I said, God, is that you? And the voice said, yes, I want to tell you something. And they had a conversation while he finished shaving. Well, maybe that's true, but the point was the voice spoke to him and he believed it like that. Think about it. As many people have pointed out, if a voice spoke to you and said, this is God talking, how could you make that voice prove it to you? Are you going to ask him a hard question or something? What are you going to do? Very difficult. A voice says, this is God talking. You say, wait a minute, I don't believe you. Quick, what's the square root of 144? And the voice says, 12. Maybe you knew that anyway. Let me see if I can think of another one. What are you going to do? Come up with some hard question you can't answer? Because any question that you can think of, well, a lot of people know the answer to it. Including this one, whoever it might be. It's very hard to establish who's speaking to you. You have the example. Look at the prophet, Muhammad. When an angel spoke to him for the first time, what did he do? Did he go running back into the city saying, it's a revelation! Praise the Lord, God spoke to me. When he ran home to his wife because he was scared, he thought he was going crazy. For 2 years he worried about it. He asked, he discussed it, he examined it, he thought about it, he was worried he might be losing his mind or somebody's fooling him. You want to make sure that's really what it says it is. Isn't that a healthier attitude than somebody who he heard a voice and said, well, it's God, nobody else can whisper inside me like that. Just worth thinking carefully. There's a second point that comes up. If everything is based on something that came into your heart, and that is, then it's not open to any test whatsoever. For people who say, my whole faith is a thing on the inside, I have to ask, see, well, is there anything that I could show you that if I could find it and show it to you, it would prove you're wrong? Well, of course not. There's no such thing. Faith is already in place. It's in here. In fact, saying there is no test of it. See, today, in the scientific community, they won't even listen to a person with a new idea unless he brings with his idea a way to prove that he might be wrong. He'll say, I believe this to be the case, but if I'm wrong, here's all you have to do to prove it. If he doesn't come with that falsification test, nobody bothers to listen to him. They're not interested at all. You have to give your idea and bring with it some way to say, now, if I'm wrong, look, try this, and you'll see. That's how the whole Quran reads over and over again. It's got many statements in there saying, if this isn't a revelation, then here's one way you could prove that it isn't, or you could do this, or find this, or show me this, you'll prove that it isn't a revelation. If it isn't, it comes with these tests built in. But that is an impossible thing to find in a system that is not open to that kind of thing. It's not open to any test. When people believe that way, or they follow that kind of attitude, They may even think that it's something that they figured out themselves. I hear that from time to time people will say, look, everything else in life is objective. You have to be like a judge in a court, carefully weigh the facts and so on. Religion is different. Subject comes from the heart. They'll usually tell you they figured that out themselves. Well, maybe they did, but people have been saying it for a long time. The man who made it the most popular was a man named Schleiermacher, who lived about 140, 150 years ago. At that time, the scientific community were challenging a lot of religious people by saying, look, you really believe this? Look, we have proof it isn't true, and intimidating them that way. Schleiermacher came up with this piece of advice to the religious community. He said, next time somebody tries to bring you some fact to prove you're wrong, you tell them you're not interested, because your belief is in your heart. It doesn't depend on what you see with your eyes. There's one last way that people can fool themselves, I suppose, and that is by false analogies, somewhat like I was talking about before, where they'll tell you, look, if you can't understand this, it's like that, which just makes two problems. Now they have to get you to understand this thing and then show you why this thing is really like that thing. But by false analogies, I mean, they tell you a nice story, which sounds like it hangs together, but it really isn't the same as the story that they want you to believe. As an example, the same man in Australia said to me, do you understand God? I told him I did, but he wanted to say, no, you can't, and so on. So, okay, for the sake of argument, I don't understand God. He says, if you can't understand God, then how do you expect to understand the Trinity? Well, because these are different things, that's why. God I know about. I have evidence for God. The other item, I haven't seen anything like that. No evidence. Usually it's put this way. Very often I'll say, the impossible things are mysteries. Gets the thing, mysteries. This is something that, it's like the sun. If you turn and look at the sun, in just a second, oh, you have to look away, it's too bright, burns your eyes. That's what a mystery is. It's a truth, but it's so big that when you look to it, it just burns out your mind. You just can't examine it. It overloads the circuits. So you have to look away. That's what a mystery is. It's like the sun. Well, it's an interesting kind of a parallel, but it doesn't work. I can't stand and look at the sun, but I know it's there. I can prove it in many ways. Blind men know about the sun. They don't doubt it. They've never seen it, but they know it's there. They feel it on their face. There's all kinds of ways to make sure the sun is there without looking at it. But when you're talking about a truth, you're saying this is a true thing, which organ do we have that sees truth? We have an eye that sees colors and an ear that perceives sound. What organ do we have that sees truth? Just the mind, just that faculty. It's traditionally said in Islam, the faculty of reason was the best thing God gave man. You recognize the truth with this. It's the only organ you have. If somebody says this is true, there's only one thing to use to look at it, the mind. And if you say this true thing burns out the mind, well, it doesn't even matter if it's true or not. I don't have to believe it. I have no way to make sure of it. There's a lot of things that make my head spin. How can a person be asked, insisted on, that you believe what you're not permitted to see? To say, look, this thing makes your head hurt, but believe it. The more it hurts, the more reward you get, I guess. Doesn't say that in any scripture anywhere in the world that I know of. That your reward comes with the more impossible things you believe, the bigger your reward. There's also this point, and maybe it's the toughest one I try to make, but the shortest, I'd be glad to hear, that in spite of all these difficulties, if you say, look, this can't be so because of that and so on, there are those who would still try to say, but God can do it anyway, because of what God is. Well, it's a serious logical error to say that God can do anything. It means he can do stupid things. It means he can lie if he wants to. To say God can do anything, blanket coverage. He does godly things, to start with. So you should be cautious with that terminology. But where people are using that is to say that, well, God took off some of his godliness, you see, like a coat, and he set it over here, and then he took on the shape of a man. Well, there's a lot of things that you can take off like a coat, or you could be the prime minister of a country and you can resign, and so this thing leaves you like you took it off like a coat. You can resign a lot of things, you set this aside, but by definition, you can't stop being God. You can't set it aside. It can't be done. For the simple reason that God is not what you are, it's who you are. That God is unique. There has only ever been one. God is not a job that different people get. It's His turn to be God. God is who you are. When you talk about the God, you only mean this one individual. You're not describing or making a description that could fit some different individuals, but it fits in particular that one. You're talking about who, not what. And if God is who you are, not what you are, you can't take it off. A person can change his name, doesn't matter, he's still who he was before. It's wrapped up in you, you can't separate it. God is who you are, you can't take it off like a jacket, any more than you can put it on. For those of some say that God gives us a little bit of divinity, he makes us a little bit divine, same problem. When you say divinity, you're talking about something that is always the case. It's not an achievement, it's not a goal, it's not something that didn't used to be, but now it is. That's what you mean when you talk about God, divinity. That which is all wrapped up in the identity of an individual. It doesn't come separate from him in any way. The other half of the story, I suppose, concerns man's troubles. As a lot of people will say, by all means, the human race, I don't suppose, does, but a lot of people will say, man is fallen, so he needs to be saved. This is sort of explained in this way to say that, well, since a man is all corrupted by sin, whatever he does isn't worth anything anyway. So what he has to do is let somebody else do the saving, and then he's changed into something else, a different kind of a creature. Well, the problem is that whole idea doesn't let you get started. You see, if you are corrupted by sin and what you do doesn't count for anything, I'd suggest even when you make a decision to take advantage of the ransom sacrifice or whatever, it still doesn't mean anything, doesn't count for anything. You're corrupted. You're too corrupt to have anything you do be worth anything, including that. It's something like a verdict that comes up from time to time in court cases. Some man may get a hold of a gun and he kills half a dozen people. They try him in court and say, well, he's innocent. He was insane. Lost his mind. So he's not really guilty of killing anyone. He was out of his mind. It's somewhat the same thing. If you say, man is so corrupted that he cannot do good. And the same people tell you there's one good thing you can do, you can join up with this outfit and then you'll be saved. When really you want to plead insanity. No, I'm too crazy. How do I know I'm doing the right thing? I'm too corrupted by sin. How do I know that's a good idea? My sinful nature fools me. It doesn't let you get started. I'd also suggest that there's one man, he wrote an interesting account of some of his activities about 300 years ago. British man, I believe, but he came to the U.S. He was a Universalist. And he wrote about how he used to go from city to city and argue with the religious figures in each community. And they were all telling him, you've got to take advantage, you've got to join up so that you're saved from your sins. And he'd always ask him the same story. He'd say, where did I get this sin that I'm guilty of before I did anything? Where did the sin come that I was born with? Where did it come from? And they tell him, well, your great ancestor, Adam, he sinned. He passed that sin down to you. And the man says, I don't believe that. And the preacher would say, it doesn't matter if you don't believe it. It's still true. You're guilty. So then he'd say, well, how do I get saved from this sin? Because you must believe that Jesus paid the price. What if I don't? then it won't help. You must believe it for it to work. So, you see, the picture is, you're guilty whether you believe it or not. But the only way to get saved is to believe it. It only works if you believe it. As he would go on to point out to people, he'd say, so what's the difference if I believe it or not? Did he die for all men's sins or not? If he died for all men's sins, what difference does it make if I believe it or not? He died for mine. Even if I don't believe it, he died for mine. Well, what is the difference? I used to tie them up and go round and round in circles, and in his day he was an unusual man, but today you hear a lot more of that kind of thing, that people realize the whole picture doesn't quite hold together. It comes up, unfortunately, it goes by the same name as another controversial subject. Creationism is talked about a lot, in North America at least. And by that, they mean that God made man like this, he put them together. But the older meaning of that word creationism referred to the difficulties of inherited sin. Because it was pointing out, where is this sin that everybody has that they're born with? And the teaching is, it's on your soul. And you say, where did the soul come from? Did my parents make it when they made me? No. God makes the soul, and the parents make the person, and God puts the soul in. So they say, well, then how did it come with the sin? Did God make it with the sin on it and give it to me? Say, no, you inherited the sin from your parents. Yes, but I didn't get my soul from my parents, so how did the sin get there? How did the soul come with the sin? So some, in order to explain that, came up with another thing, which you don't hear talked about too much because it was never popular. But they talk about what's called traducianism, which is to say, well, we were wrong. After all, God does not make souls. The parents make the soul along with everything else when they make the baby. And that's how the sin gets planted in there. That's an idea that never really caught on, but that's how people try to explain away this thing. So, in conclusion, what I'm meaning to get at is not to say, I have a whole lot of ideas here, and the idea is to prove that somebody's wrong and I'm right. I'm not even interested in that. What I'm interested in is that people realize there are a lot of questions that deserve to be re-examined. That it's not such a neat, wrapped-up case anymore. It needs to be thought about. People give the impression sometimes that they're thinking about it. You know that half of the printing done in the United States is done by just a small group, a handful of churches. Half of the printing, I'm talking about all the paper and ink in the United States, is used up by a handful of churches. You'd think that means they got a lot to say. But in all that printing, they don't look at these issues. You see, my point is, even if the Muslim is wrong, somebody has to be able to establish that that's the case. It has to be examined again. We can't just say, well, they always told me that, and this man's smarter than me, so he must know, and leave it at that. We're supposed to finish all things. The Quran mentions in a verse about one man who was guilty. He was a criminal. What was his criminal act? It says he heard something, and then he didn't check on it to see if it was true. It's a crime in Islam. If you hear something, but you don't make sure it's true, you just let it rattle around in your head, maybe forget it, maybe keep it. What you hear, you're supposed to check on. If it's an argument, go through it yourself. If it's a fact somebody said is in that book, well, then you ought to find that book or find somebody that's seen it. Make sure what he said is true. So I thank you for your time and attention. I'm glad to have the chance to be here. I believe that time was set aside for some questions, so we'll see what we can do. Alhamdulillah. I'm just going to suggest, maybe if you don't feel at ease standing up in front of a crowd or whatever, maybe you can write a question on a piece of paper and pass it up as well.
Sir, it occurs to me that though various religions sprang up different times from different countries, they all preach and teach the same fundamental truths. If I may summarize in three words, love all, hate none, we are one. They, I think, never divided the one humanity into races under various labels. I think they also, the planet Earth as one country and humanity as one family. But under the very guise of the very same religions, under various labels, the followers have divided the humanity into various countries and into various religions, and wars and fights are going on. Countries manufacture arms, they maintain military armies, produce nuclear weapons, and it seems that Satan is more powerful than God now. I think we have to, it seems that we have come to a cynic turning point, a climax in human civilization, that we should get all the basic teachings, fundamental teachings, the agreeable teachings of all religious teachers and teach them under one title, like world government religion, to unite all for the welfare of all and to prevent a nuclear war which would bring about total annihilation.
All right.
Just on my comment, all right. In a sense, I suppose I agree with you right down the line. It's just that I have to qualify that sometimes when that sort of thing is stressed to say, this is our problem, we have to solve this, so we shouldn't necessarily talk about these other things, is often what happens to people. They don't talk about these details of theology and so on. Well, it might seem to be a good idea, but the difficulty concerns, back to the thinking again, that things are all supposed to be one piece anyway. So unless you get some of the important things sorted out, you're not going to function properly in this other project you're trying to do anyway. As I said, told the story about one man who's a famous preacher who, he said there was a certain thing that he just couldn't believe it was true, but every time he preached it, his head hurt. Because he couldn't believe it was true, but he knew it was part of what he was supposed to preach, and his head hurt. And then one day he promised God that he wouldn't doubt it anymore, and he said the headache went away. Head doesn't hurt anymore. Well, he disconnected a valuable circuit in his brain. His brain's trying to tell him, not so fast, something's wrong here. So if you tamper with the circuitry and say, now this doesn't make sense, but I'm going to hang on to it anyway, suggesting that influences the processing, the output is going to be influenced by this if it's not, if everything is not functioning properly. Just a thing I mentioned the other day, you can take an elaborate computer, if you sneak around behind and open the cabinet and maybe cut one wire, the thing will still work most of the time. But every once in a while it'll spit out some nonsense because you've damaged it somewhere. So it's not necessarily advisable to lump up a lot of things and say, well, these don't matter, we'll set them over here. Maybe a lot of things don't matter, but we've got to be careful which ones we set aside. Say, these things don't matter. Just as if somebody says, well, if God is one or five or seven, it doesn't really matter. Now, I would dispute that. I think it matters, because if you get that wrong, you're going to mess up somewhere else later down the line. But I think you probably agree with me there, too. I'm just adding that to what you said, that sometimes people, maybe the only thing they know is to say, no, love, 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 love. See? And they say that, and you have to wonder, do you even know what you're talking about? Love? Love, if I love somebody, is when if I see that he's doing something that's going to hurt him, if I love him, I'll tell him, that's going to hurt you. So sometimes love may mean you have to be harsh to somebody, or tell him something you didn't want to hear. The boy says, love, love, love. Oh, say what you like. I love it. Beautiful. You may not even be loving the man. You're doing him harm. He needs to hear some advice from you sometimes. Some advice he doesn't like. Okay?
Yeah. love, to believe in God, to believe that the Quran is a revelation, and we believe the Prophet Muhammad is the messenger of God. Take the other religion in Sri Lanka in praise for the Trinity. Buddha, Sarana, Sacchami. Dhamma, Sarana, Sacchami. Sarana, Sarana, Sacchami. I take the views in the Dhamma. I take the views on the Buddha. I take the views in the Dhamma. I think Buddhism also is based on the Trinity. Shiva, the creator, Shiva, the sustainer, Shiva, the destroyer. Christianity also is based on the Trinity. Christ, the Father, Christ, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I want to know what the other speaker, if that is so in two religions, that is, in Islam and Buddhism, the triple idea is separated. In Christianity and in Hinduism, the triple idea is one. I would therefore the teacher, the learned lecturer believe that in Christianity too, that Christ, they are two separated. God, Christ, the Bible, the Holy Book, and Christ, the Messenger. Do they believe it in that way, or do they believe Christ as God, Son, and the Holy Book?
I don't think there's a problem. There are a handful. There are no Christians aside from one
handful who call themselves Jesus only, who believe that Christ is all three together. That's a very heretical view, just as I don't think there are any Hindus who talk about Shiva 1, 2, 3. Shiva's the name of one individual. What you're talking about is a long ways from trying to make some kind of a parallel. You're saying there are, in all religions there are three things. Yeah, there's a lot of boxes I open up and there's three things in them. What does that mean? One time Jesus said, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, what do you mean? They're all three? Each one is the father of the other? You're naming three items. A Trinitarian doctrine is saying, I have three items, and each one is the whole thing. And you don't have that in Islam. You have Allah. And Allah is not the Quran. And the Quran is not Allah. The messenger is not the Quran, nor Allah, and so on. There's no parallel whatsoever. It's saying there's three things. And I can name four and five and so on. There's this, and there's this, and there's this, and it's none. If all you want to do is say, in every religion I can name three objects, yeah, I agree with you. If you want to say, in every religion I can find Trinity, I tell you that's not true. You find Trinity in some religions and some you don't. Because Trinity says, this one is God, and this one is God. But this one is not this one. These are different. But there's one God. That's the starter. That you find in a lot of religions. You don't find that in Islam. You don't find it in many religions. You don't find it in Taoism, for example. It's one of the, in my opinion, the nicest book I ever read in the last few years was the Tao Te Ching, because the thought in there is very Islamic. I don't think many Taoists realize that. God is one and so on is a very clear kind of a thing. But anyway, you're entitled to your opinion. Anybody else? Oh, yeah. No, that's worrying, but it's not relevant. Quran describes hell and heaven. Hell, an unpleasant place to stay. Heaven, a good place to live. I want a logical explanation for heaven and hell and torture in the grave. Well, to start with, the Quran does not talk about hell and heaven, okay? Unless you understand those words properly, it nowhere talks about heaven, nowhere. It talks about a garden, and it talks about paradise, but doesn't talk about heaven. It talks about the heavens, which you look and you see overhead. It doesn't talk about you, your reward, you're going to live in heaven. But a long time ago, that word heaven didn't mean heaven up there in the clouds. It meant haven, meant a nice place to be. So if that's what you mean when you say heaven, yes, God is going to provide a nice place for me. But in heaven, no, that's a different story. Same goes for hell. Hell used to mean, centuries ago, the grave. It's where you buried things. When you buried potatoes, they used to say you held them. You were helling potatoes. You put them in hell, and you dug a hole and put them in. Now hell comes to mean something like a burning, fiery place. Well, the grave is one place, and this burning, fiery place you're talking about is another item. That goes under the name Jahannam, or Jahim, or Gehenna. Gehenna is not hell. It's by hell, you mean the old grave. But as to what does the Quran say, if you want a logical look at life after death, the scientists today accept, generally speaking, and maybe there's some that don't, but generally speaking, the scientist accepts as a basic article, although he can't prove it, but he accepts it, what's called a conservation of matter and energy. Which means if I have some matter, I can squeeze it and crush it and kick it around and grind it up and burn it and do whatever I like. I'll never get rid of one bit of it. It will still be there in some form. You cannot destroy matter. You can turn it into energy even, and the energy you can turn back into matter. But the total amount of matter and energy never changes. Doesn't grow, doesn't decrease, no matter what you do. And that same man, if he's deeply involved in physics these days, you ask him, what is matter? So you keep going to the bottom. What happens? You keep taking things apart. You keep finding smaller and smaller pieces. Until you know, well, actually, what you get down at the bottom is not a piece of anything. You just get an idea. You get a thought. You've got a relation between this and this. You don't have any pieces left. You just have relationships. An idea. Well, put all that together. What does that tell you? If you have a man, and he's dead, and you crush him and grind up the body or burn it or whatever, can you completely get rid of him? Can you completely smash him out so he does not exist anymore? What happens to his thoughts? They might be damaged. His thinking might be pretty cloudy. But can it completely disappear? Well, the scientists, if you think about it that way, I'd say, well, no, of course not. You see, you... has to be someplace. And that's basically what the Quran tells us, is what the Bible says, for that matter, what the Jews believe till now, that when man dies, it's like falling asleep. His thoughts are something like thoughts when people dream. They're not particularly clear necessarily, but there's some kind of awareness, no matter how crushed up his bones are. Some little bit of him still is hanging on, because you cannot spread him far enough that he disappears. And so the Quran says the grave is something like sleep, and one day you'll be reassembled and you'll think you've only been asleep for a little while. People say it's only been a day or two, hasn't it? And the Quran mentions something like this, that we've just gone for a few hours. But now, whether the grave is a comfortable place to rest or uncomfortable depends on what's on your mind. You see, suppose you are a condemned murderer, and they tell you tomorrow morning, when the sun is up, you hang. And then your jailer puts you in a cell, he says, pleasant dreams. See, if you can get to sleep that night, probably you won't have pleasant dreams. What's on your mind is, 6 o'clock in the morning, I hang. On the other hand, if it's 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, you leave on vacation, probably you have pleasant dreams, at least if you can get to sleep. You know what's waiting for you when you get up. And so it is said of the grave, that people know what's waiting for them when they wake up. So whether they're resting comfortably or they're tossing and turning, that is mentally, depends on what they know. They know what to expect. There's no surprises, the Quran tells us on the judgment day. No surprises. It's not a matter of people are going to be waiting for the verdict on the judgment day saying, what is it going to be, heaven or hell? Oh, nothing like that. It says, you know, long before you get there, you know, because it says in one verse, at the judgment day, each man's record will be put in his hand. You look at it and say, yeah, it's obvious. No surprise. I hope the judge is in a good mood or something like that. That your record is in your hand, you can figure it out. Now, if that's true, that means at any given moment that somebody said to you, you ready to die? You should be able to think about that for a minute. A Muslim could say, well, no, as a matter of fact, I'm not. Or he might say, yes, all right, I'm ready to die. That doesn't mean he believes, oh, I'm guaranteed some kind of a place in paradise right away like that. But he knows when he's ready. He's got things in place. He may even think, no, I haven't made up for this, and I haven't looked after that, and this piece of business is unfinished, and that can't be helped, maybe. But he knows when he's ready. The difference between that attitude and the attitude of some other people is that if you ask the Muslim, are you ready to die today, he may be able to tell you yes. But if you ask him, will you be ready to die a week from tomorrow, he'll tell you, I don't know till a week from tomorrow. He will not tell you, but some people say, anytime. I have a contract with God. Says, I'm saved. It's already been taken care of. The Quran talks about that in the second surah, twice mentions this. Speaking of some people, says, do they say they have a contract with Allah? I want to point out that that's a thing to say, but can you prove it? Show me the agreement he made that says, don't worry about it. You can die anytime. Everything has been looked after. Nobody has. But at the same time, nobody's in doubt. They know what to expect. In fact, they tell it. There's a well-known story when the Muslims 14 centuries ago, and there's still just a handful of them in the world, in Mecca, is it the Khubaib? And the Meccans had told him they were going to crucify him. Said, you won't leave this religion, then we are going to kill you, but we will give you some time to make some prayers before we execute you. So Khubaib went over, and he prayed just two quick prayers. And he came back and he said, I would like to pray longer, but you would think I'm afraid, so I cut my prayer short. Let's get on with it. That can be the position of the Muslim. Okay, sorry that takes so long. Well, this is interesting. Remember I mentioned before, I said there's one church that insists that the Christian should not eat pork, and they prove it from Bible verses. There are other churches who will insist on just what the subject of this question is. Is there any mention in the Bible that Christians must not touch liquor? There's some churches will tell you, yes, they'll prove it to you from the Bible. Because they look very, very carefully at the words. In some churches, it's forbidden. They base it on this consideration. They read where it says, Jesus drank wine. And they say, but wait a minute. Wine is our translation of a word. What was it he was drinking? So they look back through the whole book to see, what does this book say about wine? And you come to a passage, you can find it if you have a concordance of the Bible. Look up wine. You find in the Old Testament a place where, in a sentence, it talks about wine and strong drink. So based on that, they say, well, whatever this word wine is, it's not strong drink, because in this sentence it says wine and strong drink when discussing beverages. So based on that, they'll say the Christian shouldn't drink wine. As I said, I wish that maybe someday somebody will come up and sponsor some energetic person to do their research for several years, but I'm convinced that if somebody looked at all the reasons why one church splits from another church, in most cases, they are Islamic reasons. What I'm saying is, you could take the whole content of Islam and base it on the arguments of this church and that one and that one and that one. They've all done at least one of the arguments based on their sources for what is part of Islam, whether it is pork or blood or alcohol or on up to doctrines and so on. Does the Bible say that a Christian man cannot have more than one wife? Yeah, as a matter of fact, it doesn't. It does say there is a recommendation given. Paul is writing about bishops or whoever looks after a congregation of people, however you want to translate it. They used to translate it bishop. He said, let a bishop be a husband of one wife. It's not the same thing as saying one man, one woman, and so on. It has never been part of Christianity. As recently as 300 years ago, the Lutheran Church in Germany recommended that men take more than one wife because there had been this long war that had wiped out so many men, and they recommended to build up the population. This is what we should do. It's frowned on, and it's very much a part of culture today to say one man, one wife, but technically you won't find it anywhere in Scripture that it's one man, one wife. You find Jesus talking about the importance of this bonding, how sacred it is, and two shall be as one, and so on, but nowhere do you find him saying it can't be so. The Jews, for that matter, no Jew today that I can imagine would have more than one wife. It doesn't change the fact they always used to. It used to be part of Jewish law. It was five, except for the king could have 18, which is the way the law was put together. But time and culture creep in, and then people tend to think that the culture must be based on something back in the Scripture. But no, just times have changed. It never did change the rule there. Let's see here. Oh, yes, I see how it is. Christianity has many things in common with Islam. Since Christianity was born before Islam, do you think that Christianity was an innovation, I guess, which has been misunderstood and interpreted incorrectly? Okay. Well, in the first place, I have to dispute that since Christianity was born before Islam, there are Christians who tell you that isn't true. I guess most people, they look and they see, well, Jesus lived in these years, and 600 years later, we have this other man, so this religion came after that one. But other people have studied it more carefully than that. I'm not talking about Muslims, I'm talking about people within the churches who will tell you, well, it didn't work like that. The religion that the Arabs had dates from 18 centuries at least before Jesus. And when this man Muhammad came, he merely reminded people of what they had overlooked or still had in their possession but had corrupted. He really didn't tell them anything new. They were already they knew who was Abraham and his sons, and they knew a lot of the stories of the prophets. They still today stood there where Hajar and her son Ismail are buried. It's always been part of their tradition. We had a man came one time to a meeting we gave, and he came up with a question time, and he says, I have a book here that's be too much for Muslim ears. He says, you dare not let me read it. So the chairman said, oh, go ahead, read. You have 2 minutes. What do you want to tell us? So he proved it. It was from a Christian book. It was all the archaeological proof that Islam was not a new thing. It had been around for centuries, since the time of Abraham. The Muslims had all of the Arabs had all of these beliefs, all the details from Islam. And he sat down, and he was very happy. I said, thank you, that's what I believe to start with, and you proved it to me. He was under the impression Islam started 14 centuries ago, and if he could prove to me it was just an old thing, that somehow it was a fake thing. Matter of fact, the Muslim believes it goes back, as far as men go back, it's always been around. Maybe not by that name, but it's always been around. Okay, let's just make another. Jesus can't be the Son of God because if so, Son and Father must be the same. That is, Father equals God, Son equals God. The Father hasn't a Father, so that's not true. That was my argument, I guess. I think that's what you said. What about Cain? He was Adam's son. Adam is a man. Cain is a man, but Adam had no father and was a man. Well, to start with, it was not Adam's, I'll get into trouble here, but I'll point out to you, the Quran does not specifically say Adam didn't have a father. It doesn't specifically say that. It seems to indicate that. It's perfectly compatible with everything that's in there, but specifically it doesn't say that. But for the sake of argument, suppose he had no father. The point is, by nature, what is he? What is he made to be? He is a reproductive item. His life came from somewhere else. He doesn't contain it in himself. He was whatever, a lump of clay or something, and someone else gave him what made him live. So he is one of those beings who they have to get their life from somewhere. They don't have it. That's what being a man is. And his son was just like that. He had to get his life from some place. Those were the 2 points that I was actually making. That to be a son means you get life. That's what makes you a son. If I point to this one and say he's a son, but nobody gave him life, well, then he's not a son. Just as the Bible says of Adam, he was the son of God, Luke chapter 3. Son, in that sense that somebody had to give him life, so we're all sons of God, we come down that chain. If that's what you mean by son, you got life from somebody. So whether he personally had a father or not is beside the point. Let's see. Muslims don't reject everything they don't understand. I was talking about water and so on, as I did. Same here. I can't understand how Jesus can be God as well as man, the Son of Man as well as the Son of God. But I know Jesus. I've spoken to him and he to me. He loves me. I love him. I know him better than I know my own mother. I haven't seen him with my physical eyes, just as a blind man knows there is a son, even though he can't see it. I know Jesus is God because I know Jesus. But we talked about this kind of thing. Okay, somebody says that. How can I argue with you? How am I going to tell you you didn't? But as I suggested, that if somebody says they've heard a voice and someone is speaking to them, they should make sure that that voice is who they said it was. I used to have a newspaper clipping that I carried around in my wallet until it fell apart. It was about a woman who had taken her children and chopped them up in little pieces and threw the pieces off a bridge into the river. And when they asked her, why did you do that? She said, God spoke to me, told me to. She said, the point is, a lot of people hear voices, but be careful. There's even a passage in the Bible that says, keep on testing those spirits. It's talking about that very thing. If you think somebody spoke to you, well, test them. Test that spirit. See if it is who it says it is. That's all. Whether the whole episode happens this way or not, I wouldn't argue, but I would suggest that anybody who says that Jesus speaks to me ought to ask again, how do you know that? Because you feel it? I feel tired. I mean, it doesn't. Your feelings don't really prove very much. Some grown men are afraid of spiders. Why? Because they're going to hurt them? No, they can't help it. That's the way they feel. They can't help their feelings. So your feelings are not always a safe guide to what is true. You might even say, logically, I know this little animal cannot hurt me, but I can't help it. Get him away! You see, that's your feeling. So you can't trust that same faculty to tell you, oh, this is true, this is false. How did Muhammad test the angel and find out he was from God? Well, I suppose that may be a bit of a long story, but it basically comes down to what a lot of non-Muslims have investigated. They did. They continue till now to do a lot of work to prove that to them, to prove the situation. They do it this way. Take a minute to bear with me. You see, this man claimed that God spoke to him. He told people, God spoke to me. So you're left with two options, basically. Either he was lying or he was deceived himself. Somebody fooled him. So he was either a deceiver or he was himself deceived. And there are two schools of thought by the non-Muslims. They write volumes and volumes of books on the one hand, and they'll tell you, having investigated the life of the man, what we know is, since this wasn't a revelation, we still have to explain these difficulties. There are things about his life that have to be explained. And since the book is not a revelation, the only explanation for these facts is he was a liar. Now, other people say, since the book is not a revelation, we have to explain these facts. They're different facts, different things that have to be worried about. So the only way to explain these facts is the man must have been fooled. Somebody fooled him. So this answers all these difficulties, and this answers all these difficulties. You mention some of these problems, people say the explanation is he was a liar. You mention some of these difficulties, they say the explanation is he was fooled. But they don't realize you can't be both. If you are a liar, then you're not fooled. If you're fooled, you're not lying.
You see what I mean? If a man is a lunatic, he thinks that an angel speaks to him. And somebody asks him a question, and that's how a great deal of the Quran came. People ask questions of the Prophet. Would you please be quiet so the rest of us can hear? Thank you. When people would ask him a question, he waited for the angel to speak to him, tell him the answer. This would be the revelation. If you're a crazy man and you think that's what's happening, then when somebody asks you a question, you think, well, wait. Come on, angel, tell me. You don't, if you are a crazy man, think, how am I going to find out the answer to that? I'll be back tomorrow. And you go home and you get your friends together and you say, does anyone know the answer? And tomorrow, I'll go and lie and tell them the angel told me. You see, you can be a liar or you can be deceived, but you can't be both on exactly the same subject. And that's basically the point, and that's what went through his mind in that regard, to say, if I'm being lied to, then why this? If I have fooled myself, why this? And so on. But that would take some itemizing to try to put that out. It's the kind of thing that people still worry about today. The Quran mentions that thing. It points to something telling you, if he is not a prophet, then where did he get this information? So then you have to come up with the source of that information, if you possibly can. But it reminds you that, you know, the difficulties of, you won't find the source of that information. If you think that somebody gave it to him, then how do you explain this, his attitude on such and such an occasion? Why is it, if he was a liar, did he predict to people's faces what they would and would not say? Where did he get the confidence to do that if he knows he's faking? And so on. The Quran says the Bible has been changed. It does not say that. Okay? That's a big misunderstanding among Muslims. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say the Bible's been changed. In the first place, it doesn't say Bible anywhere in the Quran. It doesn't say Bible anywhere in the Bible. Okay? Just to start with. The Quran says a number of things about Scripture, but that's mainly the subject tomorrow night. It says of the material that people have in their hands that sometimes they fool themselves with their own forgeries. That is, some of what they have in their hand, they wrote themselves, or the community wrote it, and they claim it came from God. They have an old book which a man wrote, and now they say it came from God. Which is basically the same thing the mainstream of Christianity says now. Most Christian churches tell you exactly that. Yes, some of the Bible is God's words, and some of it men wrote. Look, it says here, you have clear statements like that in the Bible. You have Paul, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he says, what I'm about to tell you didn't come from God. It's my idea. It specifically says, warned you ahead of time, God hasn't told me what to say on this subject, so I will give you my opinion. So if somebody says, no, every word came from God, well, they're arguing with one of the writers. To start with, that's just one indication. So that's what the Quran really says about the Scriptures. They have some things that they give some authority to that they shouldn't. I know that a lot of Muslims are under the impression that it's like once there was a true Bible and then somebody sat down and he erased a few words and he wrote in some other words and stuff. It doesn't say that anywhere in the Quran. And the one verse that's often quoted on that subject just shows that people haven't looked into it thoroughly. There is a verse which says they changed the words from their right places. But if you read that in its context, it's talking about the very thing that continues till today. It's talking about when a man has a thing in front of him, but he gives it to you in another form, is what's in front of him. Related specifically to an episode where a Jew was arguing about a point of law, and the Jew was saying to the Muslim, it doesn't say that anywhere in our book. And he opened up his book and he said, look, and read like this. You see, what your book said is in my book isn't there. And it reads like this. And the Muslim, do you mind? He lifted his thumb off, and there's the word. See, so it was there, but he didn't say that it was there. And you have the same thing going on today if you have people, they do it the opposite way around. If they tell you, for example, there's only one Messiah. No, the Bible is full of them. In the Hebrew, there are a great number of men who are called Messiah. But instead of writing that in most translations, they translate it. They read Messiah in Hebrew, they put anointed one. That's the meaning of Messiah. But in this verse, it seems to be talking about Jesus. It says Messiah. Don't translate it. Leave it. It says Messiah. So you read through and you get the idea there's only one Messiah. Well, there's lots of them. It's a nice title, but it's not, doesn't mean anything particularly special. It means anointed one, somebody chosen by God. Cyrus the Persian, Messiah. That's the same thing. They change the word from the right places. The truth is here, but when you say it, you say something different than what is here. When you translate it, you give something different than what is here. Okay, is that everything? No, go ahead. Yes. Go ahead.
The Quran refers to Adam or Adam, Abraham or Abraham, Yahweh or David,
Jesus or Isa, and several others as prophets of Allah. If we accept them all as prophets of Allah, it is so far in right or wrong to say that the religion taught by all these people is Islam.
Well, the Quran talks about Islam before 14 centuries ago anyway. It says this was a term that Abraham used to use and so on. It's unfortunate that in translations of the Quran, when they translate one particular verse, they translate every word except one, and it gives a lot of misunderstanding. There's a verse which says, if anyone wants a religion other than Islam, God will not accept it of him. Well, the problem is they translated all the words except the Arabic word said Islam here in Arabic, and they write Islam, I-S-L-A-M, in English. But Islam means something. It's not a label. It's not a club. It means submission to God. And the Arab reads that sentence. He reads, if anyone desires a religion which doesn't involve submitting to God, God will not accept it. Well, that makes sense to everybody. I don't think anybody would argue with that. That's the meaning of Islam. So it is said also in the Quran about, it says some people came to hear Islam explained, and when it was explained to them, they said, oh, well, we were Muslims before this. They didn't use that name, but they said, what you told us is what we believed before anyway, so I guess we've been Muslims all the time. That was my feeling. And I read the Quran and said, this is what I've been saying for 15 years. So this is Islam, so I guess I've been a Muslim. Okay? This concerns what I was saying about ball of clay and a cube. To say that if you had a ball of clay and you squeeze it into a cube, now it has corners, so it's not round anymore. That's all I said. See, what somebody's pointing out is to say, yes, but it's still clay, you see. It used to be round, now it's got corners on, but it's still clay. So couldn't it be that's how God becomes man? But see, that's exactly the point. God is supposed to mean a lot of things. One of the things that it means, you say, this is God. You mean, this one here, he knows everything that can be known. That's one of the things you mean. So that you change the shape of the clay, it's not round. That it's still clay, don't argue about it. It's not round. Just as if you could imagine that God becomes a man, it's not correct to say he's still God. Because when you say God, you mean he knows everything that can be known. Men don't have that capacity. So, whatever he is now, he isn't what he used to be. There's a verse in the Bible that's reported anyway, that Jesus said, there are things God knows which I don't know. You see, so, whoever says that, even if he used to be God, he isn't anymore. He says, what God knows, I don't know. Some things the Father knows, the Son doesn't know. I guess that's our time.